I'm Sam Fullwood, and I'm a Tar Heel. My Carolina story begins when I was 11 years old, living at home in Charlotte, North Carolina, with my parents and younger brother. It was a Saturday, March 16th, 1968. Being great Tar Heels that each of you are, you might accurately surmise that it was a basketball game that drew my attention and affection to the baby blue. Well, you'd be right and you'd be wrong. True, a memorable basketball game occurred on that date. Carolina edged Davidson College 70-66 in the East Regional Final, sending the Tar Heels to their first Final Four in the Dean Smith era. But prior to that game, I had no awareness of Chapel Hill or UNC. And if I remember it correctly, I watched the game only to be disappointed by the outcome. At that time, so long ago, and in my youthful naivete and ignorance, I would have claimed allegiance to Davidson only because I was more familiar with a local team and I was enamored of its bruising center, Mike Malloy. Truth be told, I wasn't all that much of a basketball fan anyway. I was an unathletic, nerdy black boy with Coke bottle glasses. I was more likely to remember something I read in a comic strip than the number of rebounds listed in a box score. But this game might have been the start of my becoming aware of a world outside my insular life and community. A few weeks after that Davidson game, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed on a Memphis, Tennessee motel balcony. Race riots erupted in Detroit, Washington, D.C., Chicago, and Los Angeles, among other U.S. cities. The current events of those days were impossible for me to overlook. I became an avid newspaper reader, including the sports pages. That's where I learned about Charlie Scott and his coach, Dean Smith. I read about the relationship between Scott and Smith, and that was enough to make me a Tar Heel for life. In this audience, I don't think I have to detail the specifics of that Carolina story. We all know it. But if on the off chance you don't know about the Charlie Scott, Dean Smith connection, quietly whisper to the person on your left or on your right, and I am certain that they will be discreet in educating you. Exactly one day short of a year after that 1968 basketball game, I'd become a true blue Tar Heel fanboy. Another game. This one played out on Saturday, March 15th, 1969. And another Carolina victory over Davidson in another East Region tournament, sending Coach Smith, Charlie Scott, and his Tar Heel teammates to a second consecutive Final Four. Carolina beat Davidson in that game 87-85. As I recall, on Charlie Scott's game-winning shot in the closing seconds. Though I've never met Charlie Scott and would dearly love to someday, my Carolina story intersects with his because of Scott's trailblazing role at UNC widened my eyes to a universe I had never known previously. In the year between those two Final Fours, my childhood innocence melted away. As I read newspaper sports pages about Carolina basketball, I was simultaneously exposed to something far more formative in my life. I became aware of racial realities that shaped attitudes, behaviors, and actions in places like Chapel Hill, which now didn't seem so very far away from my home in the McCrory Heights neighborhood on the west side of Charlotte. A bit of biographical context is needed here. My parents had been born and raised in neighboring small towns in rural Union County, North Carolina, during the first quarter of the 20th century. By the time they married in 1950, both had finished college and had begun their careers. Daddy, like his father, was a Presbyterian minister. Mama, like her father and all but one of her six siblings, was an elementary school teacher. These were the ideal pedigrees for Southern Black society's elite. Black people of means, like my parents, the preachers and the teachers and the doctors and the postal workers and the small business owners, settled into McCrory Heights by force as much as by design to work for upward mobility and racial progress. They lived in relative comfort and isolation beyond the oppressive purview of white people. For my parents and the neighbors, success in life meant a college education, a professional job with the government or a business catering exclusively to black consumer needs, marriage to another employed, preferably black person, and home ownership. Of course, none of this was expressly stated. It was simply assumed, as it was assumed that I would fall in line, beginning by attending a historically black college, such as Johnson C. Smith, which was a three-point shot from my front door. That's where generations of black men in my family were launched. It's where my brother would eventually graduate, where my future wife would graduate, but not me. Instead, I had my heart set on Chapel Hill. By the time it came for me to go off to college, I had my entire life mapped out. I decided to be a newspaper reporter, and Carolina was the only school in the state with a journalism school. It was an easy slam dunk decision for me, but one that greatly disturbed my mother. Mama had never been in favor of my attending UNC, nor of my decision to major in journalism. She wanted me to get a teaching certificate, a resource that I could always fall back on when this foolish notion of being a reporter faded, as she surely knew it would. Mama tried to warn me that white people had the luxury of going into fields, risky fields, like newspapers, but that I needed to play it safe. She told me, "You don't know a single person who's ever worked in a newspaper. What makes you think they will let you?" "The world is changing," I told her. This was 1974. I said, "Things are going to be different and better for me than it was for you and other black people." "Different, maybe," she snorted back, "but not better." My father offered me some different advice. "Boy, there's enough you don't know to make a whole new world." I've never forgotten his saying that to me because I wanted to know every detail of that new world. With my father's and my mother's words bouncing between my ears, I arrived on the Carolina campus in late August 1974. Despite my best efforts at appearing confident and assured, I was riddled with doubt. By the midterm of my first year, I began to imagine that I might flunk out. My terror of failure was heightened by the example of a handful of black students who, after spending most of that period engaged in a never-ending card game, disappeared. And they were never seen again. Their erasure from campus propelled me to take extra precautions. In most of the huge lecture halls, I made a point of sitting dead center in the front row where I could hear every word clearly and, more important, be seen by the professor. I wasn't having academic problems, but I imagined that I was. Sometimes I had night sweats and a recurring dream replayed in a looping and unwanted reprise. In this dream, I was taking an exam after having never attended the class. The dream always ended with me bolting upright in bed to chase it away, so I studied harder, setting an alarm clock to ensure arriving on time for every day's classes. I never missed an exam. But I took one additional precaution. I made out a budget for my time. I had been told that I should spend 14 hours in class a week and double that studying. That left 56 hours in the week for sleeping and about 70 hours remaining in the week for whatever else might crop up. I tacked a chart over my dorm room desk, a form of self-imposed discipline to make order out of chaos and fighting off fear with military-like precision. That chart stayed on my wall for all of my first semester and into my second semester, and I took it down after hearing a classmate, a white classmate in a freshman English class, aggressively argue with the professor. This classmate also reminded us every time she spoke that she had been valedictorian of her high school class. Argue aggressively that Canada was the 51st state of the United States. And that classroom experience convinced me finally, not only was I not the dumbest kid in the class of 1978, but that the dumbest one wasn't necessarily black. I rushed back to my dorm room and took down that chart and learned to relax as my confidence as a Carolina student soared. I loved being a student here. I met people who are friends to this day. Chuck, I helped charter the Mu Zeta chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, which is the oldest black Greek college fraternity in the nation and has a reputation on this campus for academic excellence. I worked as a reporter and a photographer at the Daily Tar Heel, and I even went so far as to run unsuccessfully, thankfully, for the editor's job. And though Charlie Scott was long gone, I cheered many basketball games in Carmichael Auditorium. My 4 years as an undergraduate sailed by in the bat of an eye. In the winter of my senior year, assured of graduation because I had finally passed the dreaded swimming test and the J school's difficult spelling and grammar test, both required to earn a diploma, I received a surprising phone call. David Lawrence, then editor of the Charlotte Observer, offered me a job as a night police reporter on my hometown newspaper. I was the first person in my J school class to land a job, and it was with the largest and most prominent newspaper in the state. I thought I had died and gone to heaven. This was a dream come true, a validation of everything I imagined happening in my life. A bit more complex context is needed here. You see, I had set my career ambition shortly after high school graduation and a life-changing encounter with a newspaper editor. I had been editor of my high school newspaper and thought that that was credential enough to be hired at the Observer. And somehow, I don't remember now exactly how I pulled this off, but I marched into James Batten's office and demanded that he hire me on the spot. Mr. Batten, a prominent newspaper journalist at the Charlotte Observer at that time, was the paper's managing editor and soon would be the top official of the entire Knight Ritter newspaper chain. Mr. Batten advised me to go to Carolina, to study hard, graduate, and work at a succession of small newspapers around North Carolina. He also suggested that I might one day be good enough to get hired at the Observer, perhaps by the time I was 30 years old and had won two Pulitzer Prizes. I was so naively earnest. I didn't know that he was teasing me. I thought that was the roadmap for my life, and I set out on that journey. A couple of weeks later, completely out of the blue, Mr. Batten called me back. He said that he was impressed that I had been bold enough to demand a job at his newspaper. He invited me to work as a copy boy for a few weeks before I headed off to college. And so, as it turns out, in the late summer of 1974, I was in the newsroom the night President Nixon resigned. Mr. Batten pulled me aside that night and explained that newspaper reporters and editors worked to find information that would enable people like my parents to be informed citizens and to play a role in help governing the nation. That's all it took. That's when I decided, come hell or high water, I wanted to be a journalist, and I wanted to be at the Observer by the time I was 30. So you can imagine how I felt when I got that call in my senior year. Achieving my life's ambition was a bittersweet experience. On the sweet side, I'd accomplished something truly big and meaningful to me. But the bitter reality was that I had set my sights way too low. At age 22, I had more life and career ahead of me than I'd already experienced. I realized this because I wasn't very good at my job. Very few people emerge from college, even as fine as one as Carolina, fully prepared for the complexities of the real world. I had to learn to report and to write through trial and error, lots of errors. Journalism is more of a craft than a profession. It has more in common with a musician playing the fiddle or a carpenter building a bookcase than a doctor treating a cancer patient or a lawyer representing a client. The thing that I remember best from my days as a student is the singular thing that I carried into a succession of newsrooms. And even today, I take it everywhere I go. That's curiosity and tenacity. I learned both here at Carolina because there was so much to learn and so much I didn't know, so much I'd never seen and experienced. I knew I had to work hard to understand and experience those new worlds that my father had told me was out there, waiting for me to discover. I was determined to find as many of them as I could hold in my hands and in my head. You'll recall that I said I wanted nothing more in life than to be a reporter. Well, I'm no longer among the ink-stained wretches of the world. As hard as it might have been for me to imagine when I was a student here some 40 years ago, I haven't been a real newspaper man for nearly two decades now. I left that world in 2008, having worked for papers in Charlotte, Baltimore, Atlanta, Washington, Los Angeles, and Cleveland. My career allowed me to travel to about 25 countries and meet a fascinating succession of people, some very, very famous, and some known only to their families. It was a great ride, made possible by my writing and reporting classes in Old Howell Hall on North Campus. But just as Howell Hall is no longer home for the J School, my career in journalism didn't last forever. The world changed, and newspapers changed as I knew them, and so did I. I've had three careers. First as a journalist, my true professional love. Second as a public policy analyst at a Washington-based think tank. And now as dean of the School of Communication at American University, where I want nothing more than to help it make it possible for future generations of journalists, filmmakers, communications professionals to make sense of the world and to protect our democracy in an increasing multicultural, global community. This is a safe space, right? So I'm going to confess something that I don't generally say. In each of my career starts and fits, I've had no clue about what I was doing when I reinvented myself. And that's where the Carolina bred curiosity and tenacity has served me so well. I've always wanted to learn more and try harder. That's the Carolina way. And if you, again, if you're a newcomer here, turn back to that person on your left and that person on the right to learn what I meant when I said the Carolina way. I've spoken a good bit here about my parents. That's because in their youth, attending Carolina was an impossibility. The order of their day excluded them from the bounty of this place. Yet their tolls and taxes helped make the University of North Carolina a priceless gem, and me a proud alum, even a member of its General Alumni Association. There was a time in my younger years when I was resentful of how unfair history was to my ancestors. But I've come around somewhat on such feelings to where I am now inspired by their duty, sacrifice, and contribution to pave a better way for me. Any anger has morphed into abundant pride. Though they never took a single class on this campus, by birthright, my parents were as much Tar Heels as I am. You could say that makes me a legacy, and I feel a strong desire to pay it forward. I owe a great deal of whatever professional success I've had to the University of North Carolina. And the university owes a debt to people like my parents. I know for sure they could never have imagined my standing here before you today, but I do so with full awareness and deep appreciation for my father and mother. My Carolina story doesn't end here. It's an ongoing, continuing effort to make the University of North Carolina better for generations to follow me. I want Carolina to be a place of pride for all people. That's why I consider it an honor and a privilege to serve here among you and to say, once again, I'm Sam Fullwood, and I'm a Tar Heel.